I want you to picture a scenario for a second.
Mm-hmm.
You're at a dinner party, maybe having some drinks with friends who didn't necessarily grow up in the church, and the conversation pivots to religion. Someone looks at you and asks, sincerely, okay, I get the love your neighbor part, I get the Christmas stuff, but why did the guy actually have to die? Like, physically, how does a Roman execution in 33 AD somehow fix my moral failures today?
Yeah, that is the exact moment where the room usually gets very, very quiet.
Oh, dead silent.
Yeah.
Because if we're being honest, most of us, even people who have been sitting in the pews for decades, we don't actually have a clear answer for that. We have metaphors, we have, old hymns we sing. But if you press us on the actual mechanics of it, the physics of salvation, we start stumbling over our words.
Right. It's essentially the black box of Christian theology. You know the input, which is Jesus dies, and you know the output, sins forgiven. But the internal wiring, that remains a complete mystery to a lot of people, even devout believers.
And that is exactly where we are going today. We are doing a deep dive into Adam Hamilton's book, Why Did Jesus Have to Die? And the first thing that really hit me about this source wasn't even the theology itself, it was the validation. Hamilton basically opens the files on the modern church and says, look, you are not crazy for finding this confusing.
That validation is so crucial, I think. He includes these quotes from lifelong believers who admit things like, I'm embarrassed to say this out loud, but the atonement just makes no sense to me, or I feel terrible that he died and I love him for it, but I just don't understand the math.
Yeah, the math. That's such a telling phrase because for centuries, we've basically been taught to view the cross as this transaction, a cosmic equation. God needs X amount of suffering to pay for Y amount of sin. And if you're a modern person, that transactional view can feel well, it can feel really cold, or even morally questionable.
It can feel like a legal fiction. Or worse, it can paint a picture of God as someone who demands violent bloodletting before he can bring himself to extend forgiveness. Which is why Hamilton's approach here is so refreshing. He wants to move us away from the courtroom, away from the accountant's ledger, and toward something entirely different. He argues that the crucifixion isn't primarily a mechanism at all, it's a message, it is a communication event.
A shift from a transaction to a conversation. I really love that framing. But before we get to his actual solution, which he calls the Logos theory, we need to sit in the tension of the problem a bit longer. Because there's this tendency to assume this confusion is just a modern problem. We think, oh, we're just too scientific or too cynical today to get it. But the source material makes a really compelling case that this confusion is actually baked into the story from day one.
It absolutely is. And this is a historical point that gets overlooked all the time. We assume the disciples, Peter, James, John, we assume they had the inside track. They were walking around with Jesus. Surely they understood the master plan. But Hamilton points out that they were just as baffled as anyone else. In fact, they were probably more confused than we are today.
Yeah, the book highlights Mark chapters 8 and 9, right?
Exactly. Jesus isn't being cryptic in these passages at all. He says very plainly that the human one must suffer, be rejected by the elders, and be killed. He lays out the exact roadmap. And the disciples don't just fail to understand it, they actively reject the concept.
Which leads to that famous scene with Peter. And I think we often read this scene way too quickly. We just think Peter's being his usual bumbling self. Try to actually get into his head for a second. He has just identified Jesus as the Messiah, the victor, the ultimate king who's going to overthrow Rome. And then the king turns around and says, hey, I'm going to get executed by the state.
It's a total cognitive dissonance nightmare for Peter. In his worldview, the Messiah conquers. He doesn't get crushed. So Peter literally pulls Jesus aside to scold him. Think about the sheer audacity of that moment. He is pulling the Son of God aside to correct his theology. He's essentially saying, no, Jesus, you can't say that out loud. That's terrible PR. We don't do dying.
Right. And Jesus' response is one of the harshest lines in all of Scripture. Get behind me, Satan.
It is incredibly jarring.
Yeah.
But Hamilton unpacks why it had to be that harsh. Jesus isn't just calling Peter a bad name because he's annoyed. He's identifying that the desire to bypass the suffering, to find some sort of loophole where salvation happens without the cross, is a core temptation. It's an active move away from God's purposes. But, and here's where the text adds a layer of nuance that I just find fascinating, it's not just Peter who struggles with the necessity of the death. Jesus wrestles with it too.
You're talking about the Garden of Gethsemane.
Yes. The night before the crucifixion, Jesus is praying, and he says, Abba, Father, take this cup of suffering away from me. Now think about that through the transactional lens. If the atonement were just a simple, necessary mathematical formula, if it were just input suffering, output forgiveness, why would Jesus be sweating blood asking for another way?
Such a great point, because if it was just a mechanical necessity, like gravity, there's nothing to agonize over. It's just the job you came to do.
Precisely. Hamilton uses this moment to really validate the listener. If Jesus himself, in his humanity, recoiled from the impending violence and asked if there was any alternative, then you are absolutely allowed to find it difficult, too. It is not a sign of weak faith to look at the cross and say, this is really hard to swallow. It's actually a sign that you are paying attention to the gravity of what's happening.
So we have the disciples confused, we have Jesus himself agonizing over it, and then we have the history of the church itself. The book points out something about the early creeds that I had honestly never noticed before. You look at the Nicene Creed, the Apostles' Creed. These are the absolute bedrock statements of the Christian faith. And then you mentioned the death, obviously.
Right. They state the fact of it. Crucified under Pontius Pilate, suffered death, and was buried. But Hamilton notes this massive, glaring silence in the text. They never actually explain how it works.
Which feels like a huge oversight, doesn't it? It's like writing a manual for a car and leaving out the chapter on how the engine runs.
It does feel like that. Or maybe it's profound humility on the part of the early church fathers. There is a great reference in the text to C.S. Lewis that helps explain this. Lewis argued that human theories about how the death works are completely distinct from the foundational belief that it does work. He used this brilliant analogy of food. You can sit down, eat a great dinner, and be fully nourished by it without understanding the chemical breakdown of vitamins and enzymes in your digestive tract.
I love that. So the theories, and we should probably name a few just to give people context, things like penal substitution or Christus Victor.
Yeah, let's define those quickly. Penal substitution is basically the courtroom model. You broke the law, God's justice demands a penalty, and Jesus steps in to pay your fine. Christus Victor is more of a battlefield model. Humanity was held captive by the forces of sin and death, and Jesus essentially storms the gates to break us out. These are theories. They are maps trying to describe the territory. But as the theologian Robert Jensen points out in the book, history is rich in these theories, but none of them have ever fully persuaded the church as a whole. There is no single official dogma in the creeds that says this is the one and only way the mechanics function.
Which, ironically, is incredibly freeing. It gives us permission to explore. We aren't locked into defending one rigid explanation. And that actually brings us to the word atonement itself. I was really surprised to learn from Hamilton that this isn't some ancient Hebrew or Greek word that we just carried over.
No, it's entirely English. And it's a relatively recent invention in the grand scheme of church history. It comes from William Tyndale back in the 1500s. He was translating the New Testament into English and he hit a wall. He needed a word to describe the complete reconciliation between God and humanity. And the English language just didn't have one that fit perfectly. So he literally just smashed three words together, at one meant.
The state of being at one.
Exactly. It's inherently a relational term, not a legal one. It's about restoring a fractured relationship. And that sets the stage perfectly for Hamilton's main proposal in the book. He suggests that while the other theories will, the courtroom payment, the battlefield victory, while those are valuable puzzle pieces that highlight different truths, they aren't the frame of the puzzle. He wants to offer a foundational theory that can actually hold all of them together. He calls it the logos theory.
Okay, let's really unpack this, because the word logos sounds very academic, very seminary level. It takes us right to the famous beginning of John's gospel. In the beginning was the word.
Right. The Greek word used there is logos. And the problem is, to our modern English ears, the term word sounds small. It sounds like a noun or a verb on a page, just a unit of speech. But to a Greek philosopher or a first century Jewish thinker reading John, logos was a massive, all-encompassing concept. It meant the logic, the reason, the organizing principle of the entire cosmos. It is the very mind of God being expressed into reality.
So when John calls Jesus the logos, he isn't just saying Jesus is a messenger dropping off a note.
No, not at all. Jesus isn't the mailman. He is the letter itself. He is God's internal logic made flesh and bone. Hamilton argues that everything Jesus did during his life, eating with the social outcasts, healing the sick, washing his disciples' feet, all of that was God speaking. That was God articulating his own nature in a human language that we could actually observe and understand.
Okay, I track with that perfectly for the life of Jesus, but how does that apply to the death? Because that is usually where the whole message idea breaks down for people. It feels like the teachings were the message and the death was just the painful price that had to be paid to satisfy a debt.
And that is exactly where Hamilton flips the script completely. He argues that the cross isn't the transaction that pays for the message. The cross is the climax of the message. It is the loudest, most intense, most definitive sentence God ever spoke to humanity. If you view the crucifixion as a communication event, the core question fundamentally changes. You stop asking, how much blood does a holy God require to legally forgive sin? And you start asking, what is God saying to us through this horrific event?
Man, that is a profound shift in perspective. It completely changes where the agency lies. Because a machine just runs in the background. A financial transaction just clears the bank. But a message inherently demands a listener.
Yes, and it demands a response from that listener. But here is the massive challenge we have to face. It is a message of death. It is a violent, bloody, agonizing message. So the natural question is, why does God have to speak that way? Why not just write, I forgive you in the clouds, or send an angel with a scroll?
And to answer that question, Hamilton brings in an analogy that, honestly, it just stopped me in my tracks while I was reading. He talks about the difference between a verbal description of something and a visual image. A picture is worth 1,000 words. It's an old cliche, but then he backs it up with a piece of American history that is absolutely gut-wrenching.
You're referring to the story of Peter.
Yes. And just to be absolutely clear for you listening, this isn't the biblical disciple Peter we were talking about earlier. This is a historical man named Peter who was enslaved on a plantation in Louisiana in the 1860s.
This section of the book is undeniably heavy, but it is so necessary to understand Hamilton's point about visual communication. So, to set the scene, it's March of 1863. The American Civil War is raging. This man, Peter, escapes his plantation and makes this harrowing 10-day run for his life through the Louisiana swamps. He's literally being chased by bloodhounds the entire way until he finally reaches a Union Army camp in Baton Rouge.
And naturally, when he arrives, the Union officers need to debrief him. They want intelligence about the Confederate movements, but they also ask him about his master. They ask him specifically if his master was ugly, which was the slang term at the time for being cruel or abusive.
Now, pause right there and think about the options Peter has. Peter could have answered that question verbally. He could have sat down and given a legal deposition. He could have listed out the specific dates of his beatings. He could have crafted a highly logical, moral argument about why the institution of slavery is inherently evil. He could have used words.
But words are abstract. You can debate words. You can rationalize words away if you don't want to hear them.
Exactly. The human mind is incredibly good at defending itself against uncomfortable words. So Peter doesn't speak. He simply pulls down the rags he is wearing, what is left of his shirt, and he turns his back to the camp doctor and the officers.
And there's a photograph of this exact moment. I've seen it in history books. Many of you listening have probably seen it too, even if you don't recognize the name Peter.
It is, but when they saw Peter's back, the debate ended instantly. It stopped being a political issue, and it became an undeniable atrocity. You cannot look at that specific image and say, well, it's a complex states' rights issue. There are good people on both sides. The image communicated the raw horror of the reality in a way that 1,000 passionate speeches never could. It solidified the cultural resolve that the war simply had to continue until that specific evil was eradicated from the earth.
It was a visual testimony. It entirely bypassed the intellect and hit the human conscience directly.
Well, now, bring that historical reality back to the Logos theory. Hamilton is arguing that the crucifixion is God's version of that photograph.
That is a lot to process. The idea that the cross is God turning around and showing us the scars.
In a very real sense, yes. Think about it. If God simply sent down a golden book from heaven that said, sin is highly destructive and I love you very much, what would we do? We would debate it. We would parse the original Greek and Hebrew. We would argue about the exact definitions of destructive and love. We would find academic loopholes to justify our behavior. But the cross is God stepping into human history, stripping down, and saying, look at what your brokenness, your pride, your lust for power actually does to the innocent.
It acts as a mirror for humanity.
It reveals the absolute unvarnished horror of human sin. We love to think our sins are small, right? Little white lies, a bit of corporate greed, some harmless gossip. But the cross says, no. Look closely. The root of that everyday selfishness is the exact same force that tortured and killed the author of life. It exposes us completely.
But at the same time, this is the vital paradox that Hamilton really leans into in the book. It's not just showing us our sin. It's not just this massive cosmic guilt trip designed to make us feel terrible.
No, and that is the profound beauty of the Logos. It is a dual message. At the exact same moment, the cross says, this is how violent and broken you are. It simultaneously says, and this is exactly how much I love you. Because Jesus is there voluntarily. He isn't a helpless victim of tragic political circumstances. He is a volunteer. He is consciously submitting to that violence, absorbing it into himself rather than returning it. So it speaks of severe judgment on sin and radical mercy for the sinner in the exact same breath.
That feels so much more powerful than the transaction model we grew up with. A transaction is just debt paid. It's incredibly impersonal. The bank doesn't love you and it clears your mortgage. But this is God saying, I see the absolute worst of what you are capable of, and I am still here. I am absorbing the blow.
And that perfectly explains why Hamilton sees the Logos theory as the overarching frame for the theological puzzle. If you personally resonate with the penal substitution theory, the deep sense that a severe price had to be paid for justice, you see that truth reflected in the absolute seriousness of the suffering. The price is the visual cost of sin on display. But if you lean more toward the moral influence theory, the idea that the cross inspires us to live better, more loving lives, you see that truth in the overwhelming display of God's voluntary sacrifice.
So the Logos theory doesn't demand we throw the other theories in the trash, it just gives them a proper home.
Exactly. Whether you naturally view the event as a sacrifice, a ransom paid to darkness, or a victory over evil, it is ultimately God speaking to humanity in the only language loud enough and shocking enough to actually wake us up from our apathy.
Actions speak louder than words.
The ultimate action, speaking the ultimate word.
And this connects so deeply to how the Bible talks about the word in general, doesn't it? I think we tend to think of words as passive data, like reading a dry memo at work. Okay, information received, noted.
But the ancient Hebraic concept of God's word is entirely dynamic. It is explosive. Hamilton cites Hebrews chapter 4, verse 12, where the author says, "The word of God is living and active and sharper than any two-edged sword." Think about Genesis. God speaks, and physical reality rearranges itself to obey. Light exists purely because God spoke it into being. In the prophetic books, the word is described as a fire shut up in their bones.
So if the cross is the ultimate word, the capital L Logos, it isn't just passive historical information. It isn't a history lesson about Roman capital punishment. It is a living event meant to actively do something to us right now.
That is the ultimate so what for the listener today. If you are stuck trying to figure out the exact mechanics of the atonement on some heavenly spreadsheet, you are treating it as something that happens entirely outside of you. You're treating it like God fixed the accounting books in a back room somewhere and you just get the receipt. But if it is a message, if it is God's logos, then the atonement is designed to happen to you.
It happens when you hear it, when you actually receive the message.
Precisely. When you look at the cross, really look at it, with the same unflinching honesty that those people looked at the photograph of Peter's back and you allow it to break your heart, you see the catastrophic cost of your own sin, and you see the unfathomable depth of the love that willingly paid it. That heartbreak, that realization, that is what actually reconciles you to God. That is the atonement Tyndale was talking about. It restores the broken relationship, not by some cold legal fiat, but by actively winning your human heart back.
That feels like a much more sustainable foundation for a faith.
Yeah.
A legal transaction is done once and then you just forget about it. Like I said, I pay my mortgage this month. I don't sit around thinking about the bank's generosity. But a relationship, a genuine conversation where someone has bared their soul to you, that is an ongoing transformative reality.
And it beautifully solves the fundamental problem we started the whole show with. Why did Jesus have to die? Because mere words were not enough to break through our defenses. The ancient prophets were not enough. The strictness of the law was not enough. To truly, permanently communicate both the devastating reality of our condition and the unstoppable reality of God's love, God had to embody the message in real flesh and blood, step into the crosshairs of human violence, and let that flesh be broken.
It is a complete paradigm shift from transaction to relation.
And that is exactly where the actual life of the faith is found.
You know, as we wrap this deep dive up, there's one last thought I want to leave you all with.
Yeah.
It's something that just kept nagging at the back of my mind while I was reading Hamilton's arguments. If he is right, if the cross really is God's ultimate message, his definitive mic drop to humanity, think about what that says about the fundamental nature of power.
It completely inverts our entire worldly definition of it.
Right. We are taught that power is dominance. Power is having the loudest voice in the room, the biggest military, the most money, the algorithm that crushes the competition. But here, the creator of the universe, the Logos himself, chooses to speak his most important world-altering message through utter vulnerability, through silence before his accusers, through agonizing suffering.
It forces us to ask a really difficult, intrusive question about our own lives. If that is actually how God chooses to influence the world through sacrificial love and submission rather than violent coercion, how should that radically change the way we try to influence our world today?
If we claim to be following the Logos, maybe our strategy for winning cultural arguments or leading our businesses or engaging in politics needs a complete ground-up overhaul. Maybe the most genuinely powerful thing you can do in this life isn't to conquer your enemies, but to sacrifice for them.
It is certainly a much harder path to walk. It is literally the path of the cross. But if Hamilton is right about the message, it might be the only path that actually has the power to heal the world.
Something serious to chew on this week. That's going to do it for this deep dive into Why Did Jesus Have to Die? Thanks so much for listening, and we will catch you on the next one.